Concha's rooftop had kindled Trabeau's daydream of movable Cuban beaches. It was a blustery afternoon, always good for business. High winds meant brutal erosion along Florida's Atlantic coast, a godsend for companies like Sedimental Journeys. The unstoppable sea was once again inhaling priceless waterfront, and soon Sedimental's phones would be chiming off the hook. Trabeau had first become intrigued with the possibilities of sand trafficking during the BP oil spill, when lush Gulf beaches were smeared by green-black tar and dotted with sick seabirds, flapping to exhaustion in the goo. Panic took hold in seaside communities, soiled beachfront and dying marine life being lethal to the tourist trade. Even the spring breakers, normally unfazed by stench, were fleeing the coast. The thought occurred to Trabeau that all those beleaguered municipalities would pay outlandish sums to get their beaches restored, the gunk and gull corpses buried safely from view under tons of clean, white, blindingly photogenic sand. At the time, however, Trabeau had been unable to capitalize on the crisis. He was tied up on another lucrative project, filing false claims for massive financial losses that he never actually incurred due to the drilling accident. The businesses he owned were three virtual massage parlors, a unisex waxing salon, and the obligatory strip joint. All were located in Kissimmee, Florida, 97 miles inland from the Gulf of Mexico, and therefore untouched by the oil spill. No one was more happily surprised than Trabeau when a compensatory check for $1.6 million arrived from BP. It was doubly satisfying because Trabeau didn't have to split his windfall with any lawyers, salivating hordes of whom had been trolling for fake victims up and down the Sunshine State. Instead of signing with a shyster firm, Trabeau had hunkered alone in his condo and personally filled out every claim form, diligently documenting a non-existent plunge in tourist traffic at his Kissimmee establishments following the Deepwater Horizon blowout. His meticulous fraud paid off, the BP payout being large enough to seed his current sand-dredging enterprise. The Petrolux case he would leave to Brock Richardson. Trabeau emailed photos of his unsightly, though long-heeled, rash to the lawyer, then he returned his focus to the Cuba project. A political shift in Washington was panning out in his favor. Soon he'd be able to travel to Havana with no troublesome scrutiny from the State Department. Because cultural visits were being encouraged, Trabeau had decided to present himself as a sculptor. He was already busy composing phony letters of acclaim. There was no free time to pursue Petrolux over its defective hard-on gel, so he welcomed Richardson's offer to include him in the class-action gangbang. The lawyer's newest TV commercial had begun airing on ESPN, strategically slotted between ads for Cialis and Flomax. Trabeau was back in his hotel room, watching the Miami Heat blow a 20-point lead to the Bulls, when Richardson's Petrolux pitch came on, ending with a killer tagline, "And remember, I'm not just your lawyer, I'm a fellow victim." Trabeau immediately called to congratulate him.
"Where'd you come up with that one?"
"It just hit me one night," Richardson replied without elaboration.
"I'm glad you called. I've been waiting to hear how it went with your guys." "My guys? Oh, yeah, those guys.
Did they go visit my asshole neighbor?"
"Yeah, but bad news, they didn't find your pretty lady's diamond," Trabeau said.
One of Big Noogie's crew had phoned to tell him the rock wasn't there. Richardson groaned and said,
"Shit! They turned the whole house inside out. These were pros."
"Was Yancey there when they showed up?"
"You bet. That was the whole point, right? Let him know who he's messing with."
"For sure," said the lawyer. "Did they say he's ready to sell?"
"You should go see him. Bring a contract. Get this. The geek-ass archaeologist dug up another fucking tooth on my lot. He's all stoked because this one's an incisor.
Also from a dead Indian? That sucks.
Trabeau stood in his boxers at the window, watching a mammoth cruise liner leave the port. Illuminated from bow to stern, it looked like a floating shopping mall. Destination, San Juan, Negril, or maybe the BVI. One thing was certain, all those passengers, thousands of sun-seeking zombies, had paid good money to go somewhere that had a beach.
Thanks just the same, Richardson was saying, for making that phone call. Your guys, when they went to see Yancey, how'd they get the message across? I'm just curious.
These things I don't ask. For all I know, it was a calm, friendly chat.
Right.
Richardson chuckled dryly on the other end.
I'll keep you up to speed on the Petrolux litigation. They'll never risk a jury trial, so we'll get a lump sum settlement for sure.
Any guess on how much?
8 figures at least.
Nice, Trabeau said.
Split how many ways? Depends on the number of plaintiffs. No worries, you'll be taken care of.
Much appreciated, friend.
Trabeau cracked open the window. A sea breeze brought a sweet steel drum version of One Love. The Sandman couldn't think of one good reason to drive back to Miami Beach in the morning.
What did the doc say?
He asked Richardson.
When I saw you at Louis, you were on your way to the proctologist. Dermatologist, and everything's fine,
Richardson said brusquely.
I get basal cells from time to time. It's the curse of living a sun-kissed life.
This is just a little skin tag.
Word to the wise. Keep an eye on it.
Oh, I am, said the lawyer.
Mary took Yancey to Petronia Street, where they found Blister's apartment cleaned out, except for an untouchable queen mattress and a cracked hallway mirror. Yancey noticed half-scrubbed stains from his own blood on the floor and mongoose tracks in the bathtub. The landlord said the Krills had moved out in the middle of the night. Other tenants had complained of a Ryder truck double-parked in front of the building. Back in the car, Yancey's phone began ringing. He saw it was Burton and let the call go to voicemail. Yancey had been dodging his friend in case he'd caught wind of Yancey's messy visit to the emergency room. Burton would never fall for the rake mishap story. Most criminals would have fled the country after knifing what they believed was a cop, but Benny the Blister seemed exceptionally thick. Yancey asked Mary to drive over to Stock Island, where the rents were lower. Sure enough, they came upon a Ryder truck parked at a duplex that hadn't seen a coat of fresh paint since Hurricane Donna. The truck's back door was rolled up and the cargo space had been emptied. There was no activity at the duplex. Yancey told Mary to keep driving. She said,
"No disrespect, Andrew, but I don't get what's so fun about the cop life. You spend all day in the damn car. Where's the high?"
When something big finally happens.
Like getting stabbed by a random dirtbag. What am I missing here?
It's all about catching the bad guys. Very primal.
Well, I'm primally hungry, Mary said.
You want excitement? I know just where to go. The nearest restaurant happened to be Stoney's Crab Palace, where Yancey had issued reams of gag-inducing citations. More than once, he'd shut the place down. The owner, Brennan, darted for the kitchen as soon as he saw Yancey walk in the front door. "Don't order the fish," Yancey advised Mary when they sat down.
"But it's a seafood joint."
"More like a petri dish with menus. When they say catch of the day, they mean infection." Brennan emerged, wearing a hastily donned hair cap and two left-handed disposable gloves. With a taut smile, he approached Yancey, asking,
"What brings you here, Inspector?"
"Lack of options. We'll both have the chicken, no gravy on the potatoes."
"So this isn't official business?"
Brennan glowed with relief.
"How about a cup of conch chowder on me?"
"That's exactly where it'll end up if I eat it."
"Jesus, Andrew, not so loud."
"He got 32 stitches," Mary told Brennan, "so he's cranky today."
"What happened?"
19 stitches, said Yancey. He was eyeing the baseboard beneath the table, where a hale cockroach stood, glossy and fearless.
"Does that one have a name?" "Aw, fuck!"
Brennan whipped off a shoe and began wailing at the insect, which escaped easily. Mary excused herself and went to the ladies' room. After Brennan retied his shoe, he placed a greasy $50 bill beneath the spoon at Yancey's table setting.
"Andrew, don't write me up for one lousy roach, kay?"
The bribe offer was a Stoney's ritual. Yancey made Brennan pick up the 50 and asked him if he knew a man called Blister. Brennan said no.
"Then where'd you get that thing?"
Yancey pointed at a doll-sized tunic hanging on a wall hook.
"I bought it from some lady come in last night and tried to sell me a friggin' mink."
"That was a mongoose," said Yancey.
"I told her I had no use for such a varmint, but I'd pay $10 for the purple jacket. She said, okay, it's a deal."
"That's Blister's wife."
"The jacket's for my dog," Brennan seemed obliged to explain.
Yancey heard Mary calling from the restroom, and he went to investigate, Brennan tight on his heels. Mary opened the door for them and said, with breezy satisfaction,
"Gentlemen, look what I spied."
A trail of small, dark pellets lined the dingy tile near a broken tampon machine.
"Capers!" Brennan squawked indignantly. "Some jackass from the kitchen must have spilled them there."
Mary turned to Yancey and said,
"This I find unacceptable."
They departed before their chicken entrees arrived. Yancey's midsection was on fire from the stitches. In the car, he doubled over, arms tight across his waist. Mary fed him another pain pill. Back at the duplex, the Ryder truck was gone. Yancey told Mary to park on the next block over. He selected a spot from which they could surveil Blister's new backyard, where the restless Cleroy was tethered to a crooked swing set. Mary said,
"We should set it free, the poor thing."
She grabbed one of her energy drinks and downed it like a shooter.
"How'd I do back there at the restaurant? Spotting those teeny mouse poops all by myself."
"Great eyes. You're a natural," Yancey said. "Do me a favor."
"What, go down on you? I'm not sure that's proper stakeout procedure."
"Pin your hair, zip up the fleece, and take a stroll past the duplex. See if anybody's home. And not a sexy walk, all right? A plain, dull walk like you're on your way to the post office."
Mary said, "What if I don't have a dull walk?"
"Try to blend in with the neighborhood is all I'm saying." She clicked her teeth.
"Challenging."
"Yes, I'm well aware." She set off in a flat-footed stride, arms swinging, head down. Yancey would have laughed, but his eyes were elsewhere, watching for Benny the Blister. He had a hunch that the man who stabbed him was the same one who fatally accosted the late Abdul Halim Shamoon. A gray bank of knife-edged clouds overtook the sun, flattening the afternoon light. Yancey got out and leaned against the car, waiting for the Percocet to kick in. He'd always loved the breeze from the Stock Island docks, the sharp tang of salt, iced fish, and diesel. A pair of gray doves trilled from their perch on a telephone wire, and Yancey whistled back. Looking between the houses, he saw Mary coming down Blister's street. Despite her best acting, she still stood out, like most beautiful women when they try not to be noticed. Nearing the duplex, she shortened her steps.
"No, no, keep going," Yancey coached under his breath.
Unexpectedly, she slipped out of sight. He struggled back into the car and started the engine. Moments later, the mongoose began yipping, and Yancey saw Mary sprint in her rhinestone flip-flops across the barren lawn. Somehow, she climbed the fence, hauling an object that looked like an oversized toilet seat. The instant she was back in the car, he hit the gas, heading for Highway 1.
"Nobody home," she reported breathlessly. "Boxes all over the place. Are you good to drive?"
As Yancey spun the steering wheel, he experienced a bolt of pain just shy of agonizing.
"What you got there?" he asked.
Mary showed him.
"It was lying on the ground near Cleroy. I found it when I went to pet him."
"Did I not mention he was a fucking mongoose?"
"I felt super sorry for him, Andrew, all lonely and tangled in his rope. Anyway, I thought this thing might be a clue."
"Looks more like Cleroy's chew toy."
Mary made a snarky face.
"You're welcome, Inspector."
The item she'd taken from Blister's backyard was a life buoy of the donut style customarily hung on boat cabins. The styrofoam was pocked with animal tooth marks, but the name on the life buoy was still legible. Wet Nurse. Yancey said, "Stop pouting. We'll check it out first thing tomorrow."
"Gosh, I feel so honored."
Mary flung the life ring into the back seat, pulled off her flips, and planted her bare feet on the dashboard. Mona unpacked the rest of the boxes before walking to the Comcast office to sort out a credit issue. Blister expected full cable and Wi-Fi when he came back from wherever the hell he went every day. Mona wasn't in love with the duplex, but she was glad they weren't on the run from the law. Blister swore up and down that nobody had seen him spook the Muslim off the conch train. As for the dude he stabbed, Blister said it couldn't possibly have been a real cop, or he'd already be locked up at county, no bail. That made sense to Mona. It also explained why the dude didn't have a gun. He probably got sent by somebody Blister owed money to, a list that included half the dirtbags in Monroe County. Mona didn't dwell on it. She was simply glad that Blister had decided to stay put. Island life suited her. Upon returning from Comcast, she peeked in the backyard, hoping the mongoose had gnawed through the rope and run away. But no such luck. The night before, Blister had searched the apartment for the critter's silly purple jacket. Mona didn't tell him she'd sold it at Stoney's. Her husband was aware she didn't adore his unusual house pet.
"Look on the bright side of the penny. We won't never have no snake problem with Cleroy around,"
Blister would say.
"Hell, I'd rather have snakes," Mona would fire back. "At least a snake won't get into my fucking Fruit Loops."
The Stock Island duplex was cheaper than the apartment on Petronia, though Blister had to burglarize a dollar store for the cash to cover their first, last, and security. The Ryder truck he had hotwired at Trumbo Point. Mona had quit asking where he disappeared to all day long, sometimes even overnight. She wasn't the jealous type, and besides, he always came home salty and rank. No woman worth worrying about would go near such a man. Mona had met Blister while working at a massage parlor in Central Florida, where she drew the line at hand jobs and even then insisted on wearing an oven mitt. Blister had invited her to accompany him to Key West, his grand plan being to outrun a bench warrant for undisclosed felonies in St. Augustine. Halfway down the turnpike, Blister had let on that he was driving a motorcycle that wasn't technically his, but Mona had been a good sport about it. They ditched the bike in the Aerojet Canal and hitchhiked the rest of the way. Blister's first decent score in Key West was a 48-inch flat screen that became their domestic epicenter. They shared an addiction to daytime game shows, Ellen, Maury, Steve Harvey, all the CSIs, beauty pageants, cage fights, and documentaries about polar bears. However, their tastes diverged radically when it came to Blister's favorite reality program, Bayou Brethren, which Mona thought was bogus and stupid. She didn't care for Buck Nance and couldn't wait for Crystal to get wise and dump him. His shitheel brothers were just as worthless, in Mona's sulfurous view. Brethren had triggered loud arguments in the apartment on Petronia because it was broadcast during the same time slot as Learjet Vet, Mona's beloved animal rescue show, which they couldn't record because Blister had broken their DVR in the process of shoplifting it. Mona hoped her husband's juvenile worship of the Nance clan had peaked with the idiotic tattoos, which he'd hidden from her by living for days in the same rancid shirt. One afternoon, she'd peeled off the garment after Blister fell asleep during a Maury rerun and was mortified to see the words, "Hail Captain Cock," stenciled garishly across his grimy shoulder blades. In a fury, she rolled him over, only to be confronted by the cycloptic Rooster. It was about the same time when Blister began spending more days at large. The main reason Mona didn't bust his balls for being away so much was that it left the TV under her sole control. She could catch up on all her missed episodes of Learjet Vet. When Blister returned home on this night, she was watching the one where Dr. Zeke Necrotos lands his surgically outfitted Lear 60 in foggy northern Greenland to set the fractured femur of a yearling caribou. Blister snatched up the remote and pressed the mute button. Mona rose up, saying, "I will kick your ass, Benicrill."
"Hold on now. This here's important. A game changer."
"Put the fucking sound back on."
"Baby Buns," he said, "listen to me. I'm going to be on TV."
Mona rolled her eyes.
"Lord, you're drunk. Give me the damn remote."
"I ain't had one sip. You are looking at Buck Nance's new twin brother."
"Oh, so you lost your mind is all."
"No, no, I'm joining the family. It's official."
"My ass," Mona said. "Not even a dog your age could get adopted."
"Tune in and see. We're gonna be rich."
"That ain't funny, Benny. That's just mean."
He shivered with excitement.
"It's the God's truth, Baby Buns. I even got me a agent."
Chapter 16. Yancey heard the Porsche coming from a mile away. When it stopped in front of his house, he stood at the doorway beckoning. Deb's bandage was gone, though her beak was still scabby from the flaming e-cig. She had dressed low-key in a tailored dark pantsuit and black flats. The lawyer boyfriend wore cream-colored slacks, a light blue golf shirt, and a cranberry blazer. Yancey no longer had the energy to call him anything but Brock. For some reason, he looked tenser than Deb. The couple was under the impression their diamond engagement ring was still missing, which meant that the thugs who'd removed it from Yancey's kitchen had pocketed it. He shouldn't have been surprised, yet he was. He should have felt responsible, yet he didn't. The stone would still be safe in his refrigerator if Richardson hadn't sent the two Jersey boys. Now the lawyer was bitterly recapping the discovery of tribal teeth on his property and his travails with a pesky state archaeologist. Yancey made a mental note to deliver a 5-pound sack of stone crabs to his helpful dentist and also to Dr. Whitmore, his teacher-actor friend.
"They're saying the excavation work might take years," Richardson said, "and we don't want to wait that long to build. Deb and I don't."
"That's right,"
Deb murmured, distracted by intimate articles of apparel scattered on the disemboweled sofa. Richardson noticed them, too.
You have company?
She's at the gun range, Yancey said, practicing. In truth, Mary had gone to the drugstore for more gauze and sterile tape. Yancey's swathed midsection was concealed by an XXL Florida Gators sweatshirt. Richardson said, "Let's cut to the chase. I want to buy your house, Mr. Yancey." "It's not for sale. You can call me Andrew." "The offer is $250."
Yancey crowed at the insult. "Take the money," said Deb, "if you know what's good for you."
Richardson added, "We're going to bulldoze this shitbox and put up something fabulous." Yancey was in a contemplative drift, possibly due to the medication. He said, "I'm curious, what on earth do you two see in each other?" Deb's eyes flared and she looked away. Her fiancé frowned. Yancey slipped another pill under his tongue.
"Unless you come to your senses, prepare for a future of restlessness, disappointment, and betrayal. One morning you wake up praying you're alone in bed, except you're not. Lying beside you is someone with whom you've exhausted all avenues of conversation."
The couple stood mute and rigid.
"Now's the time to reevaluate your commitment before it's too late," Yancey continued. "Besides ritually overspending on jewelry and clothes, what do you lovebirds really have in common? This ridiculous villa you want to build, it's only a diversion from the brewing domestic shitstorm. Clearly, neither of you is enthralled by the other or by this particular way of life. Brock thinks of the house as a foolproof real estate investment. Deb, you think of it as a place to get away from Brock. Meanwhile, the incompatibility question hangs, does it not, like a toxic fog. My advice is to separate on good terms and bolt for the exit."
Deb was seething.
"Don't you take this shit from him," she cried at her fiancé, who wheeled on Yancey and said,
"$275 is my final number. That's all cash, brother."
Yancey said, "It's not for sale, you poor doomed fuckwit."
"Hit him or something," Deb whinnied.
The lawyer squared up and shook a finger in Yancey's face.
"My friends from up north will be paying you another visit."
"They definitely aren't your friends," Yancey said.
"Hey, can you guys help me haul this sofa to the road?" Another unmannered departure followed, capped by a cliché of squealing rubber. Deb and her man were plainly a poor fit, although Yancey's interest in enlightening them was purely selfish. Once they broke up, the mansion-building project would be scotched, and the lot would go back on the market. Yancey's transcendental sunset view would be preserved, at least for a while. With any luck, the next buyer would have a soul. Yancey took his laptop out to the deck. There, hanging on a rail peg, was the pitted life buoy that Mary had swiped from Blister's yard. The wet nurse remained a mystery. In Florida, boat registrations list the owner but not the name of the vessel. According to the databases, no motorized watercrafts belonged to anybody named Benjamin Krill, hardly a shocker given Blister's disdain for legalities. Yancey poked around the internet long enough to find pictures of 9 different boats named the Wet Nurse, at which point he gave up. Mary returned wearing a white lab coat she said she bought at a thrift shop to help put her in a nursing groove. The rest of her medical uniform was panties and sandals. As she tended Yancey's stitches, one of her earrings dropped to the floor. When she bent to retrieve it, a bright little bumblebee peeked briefly from under her coat. Yancey said, "You went back to Wiki? Please tell me that's just henna."
"No, it's real, because that's how I roll."
Mary turned around to show off the tattoo, mid-slope on a heartbreaking butt cheek.
Am I the first girl to do this for you, Andrew?
Permanently scar themselves on a whim? Yes, I believe so.
It's not a scar, buddy. It's a commitment.
That would explain the A-Y.
Know why I put your initials down there? So I'll never forget what a pain in the ass you were.
The sight of the bumblebee gave Yancey an erection that Mary taunted as proof of his lust-crazed intent. He shuffled to the kitchen on an imaginary errand. The point, as it were, couldn't be argued. He had begun to fantasize about diving under the sheets with his houseguest. Yancey worried that pain was all that stood between him and a fateful lapse of judgment. Thank God for the knife wound. Mary drove him to the docks at Garrison Bight, where he finally made headway. Captain Keith Fitzpatrick, a friend who ran deep-sea fishing charters, told Yancey he'd seen a cabin cruiser called the Wet Nurse anchored near Sunset Key. Fitzpatrick guessed the boat's length at 31 feet and described it as a crumbling mess, possibly abandoned. "Can you take us to see it?" Yancey asked. Fitzpatrick had to say no. He was up to his bloody elbows in a 40-pound cobia that he was filleting for his two clients, who hovered rapturously. Composite flooring distributors from Chapel Hill, the men had invited Fitzpatrick to the Turtle Crawls for beers in hopes he would forgive them for arriving hungover that morning, vomiting into the bait tank, and dozing through the only strike of the day. It was the captain himself who'd reeled in the fish with which the flooring executives had victoriously posed, the photos instantly zapped to their Anglergram pages. Fitzpatrick would have preferred the company of Yancey and his sweet-smelling companion, but he perceived that the defective Carolinians were withholding his tip until he showed up at the bar. Yancey, who understood the grueling politesse of charter fishing, was sympathetic. Farther along the dock, he and Mary approached a long-haired part-time guide who, for $50, agreed to take them to Sunset Key. His nickname was Gack, and he ran a 23-foot bay boat called Marley's Ghost in tribute to Bob, not Dickens. The clues were the knit Rasta cap and a scorched glass pipe on the console. As they skimmed through a bracing chop past Trumbo Point, Mary slid closer to Yancey. For him, there was nothing better than crossing open water with a woman at your side, and he was reminded of the warmth of Rosa's body on their morning rides in the skiff. He wondered again how she could trade such times for a butcher's block in Scandinavia. The run to Sunset Key was short, and they found the Wet Nurse anchored exactly where Keith Fitzpatrick had seen it. The cabin cruiser indeed was in lousy shape, a faded, flaking liveaboard. Yancey asked Gack to circle slowly. They watched for movement, but saw nothing but a lone seagull on the bow.
"She's too low in the water," Gack observed.
He was right. The Wet Nurse was squatting and stern-heavy. Yancey said, "Let's go check it out."
"I can't put you on board, mister."
"Why's that?" asked Mary.
"'Cause it's not your damn boat. I won't abet an act of piracy."
Yancey was touched by the stoner's respect for maritime code. "Just get us a little closer, okay?" Gack pulled parallel to the cabin cruiser, but maintained a gap in case Yancey was plotting to leap to the other boat. Mary had the same worry and tightened her hold on Yancey's arm. They called out several times, but nobody stirred on the Wet Nurse. Rime on the hull's windows made it impossible to see inside where the bunks would be located. Above deck, there were no fishing rods, dive gear, not even a mop. A sloshing was audible as the boat rocked on its frayed anchor rope. Mary asked,
Is that thing sinking, Andrew?
So it appears. Gak stood up, balancing on his seat to gain a better view of the other boat's interior deck. He said,
"Damn, there's a foot of water aft."
"What do we do?" Mary asked.
"Call the Coast Guard, then go home. Ain't nobody on that boat."
"You don't know for sure," said Yancey. "Let me jump aboard."
"Stay where you are."
Gak hopped down and reached for his handheld radio.
"We'll give this another 5 minutes."
It didn't take that long. Before their eyes, the wet nurse disappeared in a hushed blue-green swirl. The bird on the sinking bow didn't bother to fly. It waited for the sea to rise beneath it, and then floated off, a whitish puff riding the wave crests. When the roiling went calm, Gak said,
"That was fucking impressive."
Mary could hardly believe it. The water wasn't deep, but the surface was choppy and churned. She couldn't see the shipwreck on the bottom, only formless dark patches. Gak was already on the phone with the Coast Guard, providing GPS numbers and a description of the lost boat. Soon, random items began floating up. Styrofoam fast food containers, plastic cups, beer cans, seat cushions, moldy life preservers, a fire extinguisher. "I need that," Yancey said, pointing at a smaller object, tan in color and crowned in shape. Gak grunted.
"What the hell for? You can buy a new one in town for like $10.
"I don't want a new one." Mary hung on to Yancey's belt loops while he painfully stretched over the gunwale to pick up what he'd spied amid the debris from the wet nurse. It was a banded Panama hat, like the one reported stolen the day after Buck Nance went missing. Yancey placed the dripping hat in the front hatch of Gak's boat.
"You ain't even gonna put it on?"
Gak said. "It's evidence."
"Get out."
Mary said, "For real, he's a police inspector."
"Shh."
Yancey made a cutting gesture across his throat as if it was supposed to be a secret. Mary acted mortified and said, "Never mind." Gak fell for it. In a low voice, he asked Yancey,
"So what's the deal? Are you, like, undercover?"
"Not anymore." Yancey threw a reproachful look at Mary.
"Is it a coke thing or what? I won't tell anyone," Gak said. "You think there's a dead body on that fucking boat?"
"We're about to find out. You might want to hide that bong, Captain."
"Oh, shit."
Gak went into a scramble. The flashing blue lights of a patrol vessel were approaching fast from the harbor. Gak pocketed the pipe, cinched his grotty hair into a ponytail, and began tidying the deck. Mary asked him not to tell the Coast Guard officers that Yancey was a plainclothes detective.
"It'll screw up our whole case," she said.
"You a cop, too?" Gak whispered.
"Dude, I'm the informant. Without me, he's got nothing."
Yancey couldn't get over what a pro she was when it came to this stuff. Absolutely stellar. He would miss the fun when she was gone. The Coast Guard crew was impossibly young and efficient. Within minutes, a diver was in the water marking the site with bright buoys. Yancey studied the pattern on Gak's fish-finding sonar, which showed that the wet nurse had settled on its side, 26 feet down. The diver wasn't gone long. He surfaced with an upright thumb, lifted his mask, and said,
"All clear!"
A petty officer told Gak that he and his passengers were free to go.
"Why'd she sink?" Yancey asked.
"Probably the bilge fittings went bad. Happens all the time."
Yancey didn't believe faulty bilge fittings sank the wet nurse. His doubts were confirmed when he overheard the Coast Guard diver telling the rest of the crew about the weird thing he'd seen on the sunken boat. 2 empty sets of handcuffs locked to the bunks. John David Ampergroat gleefully thumbed a new sheaf of Nielsen's, showing that Bayou Brethren nailed a massive 23% share in its time slot. The show was hotter than ever. America did not miss Buck Nance. More good news arrived via phone from Sheriff Sonny Summers in Key West. Buck was no longer a suspect in the Conch train killing. Detectives had interviewed a local tattoo artist who'd recently inked "Hail Captain Cock" across the shoulders of a two-bit career criminal named Benjamin Krill. The sheriff said Krill had moved out of his apartment and was on the lam. "In other words," Amp said in a level tone, "your people aren't out looking for Buck anymore." "They are not," the sheriff confirmed. "We've got a tight budget down here, Mr. Ampergroat. Very limited resources." "Yes, of course, I understand." Amp kicked off his Ferragamos and danced a jig in front of the window, fist-pumping for the wretches stuck in traffic down on Santa Monica. "We believe Mr. Nance has left Monroe County," Sonny Summers continued, "and doesn't want to be found." "It's very possible." "You're better off hiring a private investigator."
"Already done," Amp lied.
"Just so you know, Benny Krill, the man that we believe killed our Muslim tourist, he's apparently a major fan of your TV show. That's why he got the tattoo. It'll all come out in the media once we catch him, which should be soon."
"I appreciate the heads up."
"It's the least I can do, considering your generous donations to my re-election committee."
No shit, thought Amp.
"Did you get the boxed set of the series I sent?"
Sonny Summers said,
"Funny stuff. My wife thought so, too."
"Are you a fisherman?" Amp asked.
"I'll FedEx some flies made with Buck's premium rooster feathers."
Sonny Summers said, "No thanks.
Blue water's my thing."
Amp had no clue what that meant. He said goodbye to the sheriff and took a call from the junior talent agent assigned to keep an eye on Buck's hot-headed mistress. To make sure Miracle wouldn't feel abandoned, the team at Platinum Artists had given her permission to seduce one of the other brothers. She selected Junior, who offered no resistance and was properly dazzled by her talents. As Amp had correctly calculated, allowing Buck's girlfriend to switch Nance's had caused combustible rancor on the set, further boosting the ratings. Although the brothers' wives would never allow Miracle to appear on camera, she could still bloom into an important, if unseen, character, the ruthless mystery slut. Amp heard the new plotline was tracking strong in all market segments. The young agent reported that Miracle was elated to be cheating on Buck, Junior was elated to have stolen his AWOL brother's girlfriend, and Junior's wife was threatening to put lighter fluid in his mouthwash.
"Would that kill him?" asked John David Ampergroat.
"Not sure."
"Do some research, please. We don't need any more surprises."
"I'm on it," the agent said.
"And when you're done, for God's sake, delete your search history."
Amp drove to the Wilshire, where he met Rachel Kuhlman in a fourth-floor suite. His phone started ringing while his face was buried between her legs. She grabbed for his ears, but he'd already veered away to peek at his caller ID.
"No way," he gasped.
"Get back down there.
It's your husband calling."
Rachel said,
"Tell him you can't talk now because your mouth is full of me."
Amp retreated into a closet.
"My man, where the fuck are you?"
"I'm with Buck," Lane Kuhlman replied. "The where isn't important."
"So he's alive. Fantastic."
Amp strived for an approximation of relief.
"Buck's contract? Rip it up."
"The one we've been working so hard on? Why?"
"He wants a better deal, Amp. You'll need to take notes."
The connection was lousy, but the voice on the other end definitely belonged to Kuhlman. However, his tone was unfamiliar, frosty, subdued, curt.
Could he somehow know, Amp wondered, that I'm banging his future ex-wife?
Put Buck on the line, would you?
In a minute, was Lane's sharp reply. No deference whatsoever. Amp sensed that a very good day would soon be turning to shit. He wasn't wrong. The deal presented by Lane was outrageous. Buck would return to Bayou Brethren at double his salary. He'd be bringing with him a long-lost twin named Spyro, for whom Buck had been searching far and wide. The stress from that heart-wrenching quest would be used to explain Buck's breakdown at the Parched Pirate and brief absence from the show. Fortunately, Buck was whole again. His brother Spyro would move to the chicken farm and acquaint himself with the rest of the family. The newfound sibling would receive $50,000 per episode for reruns scale plus 20%. If the producers refused those terms, Buck would quit and jump networks, taking Spyro with him. Their new show would be called Bayou Blood, and it would be aired head-to-head against Brethren.
"And, oh, if that's how it goes down, I'll be moving to William Morris," Kuhlman warned Amp. "Buck and Spyro, they're coming with me."
Amp's brain was quaking. He had so hoped Buck would stay missing. The last thing the Nances needed was another brother, but the last thing the show needed was a competing spinoff.
"Lane, what is Spyro's real name?"
"Can't tell you."
"Backstory?"
"Think Elvis and Jesse Presley, except little Spyro didn't die at birth. He was kidnapped from the hospital nursery by gypsies."
"No gypsies," Amp said firmly.
"Then make it human traffickers. No, wait, a distraught woman who'd tragically lost her own child and was desperate to fill the void. That'll work. But then she turned out to be an amazing mom who adored little Spyro and made him the center of her life. When she died in a freak accident, he was devastated, quit his job, and ended up on the streets of Key West. That's where Buck finally tracked him down, homeless, grief-stricken, and disoriented. That's our pitch."
"Okay, tell me how the foster mother dies. What kind of accident?"
"She's hit by a runaway ice cream truck," Kuhlman said.
"I like it, I really do."
"On the steps of a church."
"Too much," said Amp, scrambling to keep up. "You say Spyro was so heartbroken that he quit his job and moved to Key West. Why there?"
"Because it's the end of the Great American Highway, Amp. It's where the pavement runs out."
"Are you fucking with me? Because that's like pure poetry, man. We all end up at the end of the road with nothing but our dreams. Beautiful. Though I've got to say, this lost twin thing has sort of been overdone."
Rachel rapped on the closet door to announce she was going home.
"Tell Lane I'll see him in court. Tell him to lube up."
"What?"
Lane said, his voice rising.
"Who's that talking?"
"Just the waitress. I'm at Bouchon."
"I swear it sounded like Rachel."
Amp said,
"Here's a question. Do they even look alike? Buck and his twin?"
"When they grow out their beards, they will. Close enough, anyway."
"Lane, I've got to be honest."
"No, Amp. You've got to be smart."
"Can I speak to Buck?"
"After the deal's done," Kuhlman said.
"Did you think we'd disappear off the face of the earth just to make your life easier? Seriously." "Listen, you've got it all wrong. I'm totally jazzed to hear your voice. I had every cop in the islands looking for you guys."
Amp was rattled, off his game. Negotiating naked from a hotel closet had him at a disadvantage. Normally, he'd be manhandling Kuhlman via Bluetooth while gliding through the canyons in his Aston.
"I totally get the brother concept, Lane, but the problem is those shitbirds at the network. They're going to want to know who is this Spyro guy, what's his angle, and so forth."
"Make the deal happen, or we're gone. I'm talking a cloud of dust."
"All right, you bet, absolutely,"
said John David Ampergroat, jolted to the bone.
I'll have it iced by the next time we talk. That's a promise, man.
But nobody was on the end of the line. The duplex was buzzing when Yancey and Mary arrived. Parked out front were two sheriff's cruisers, Rogelio Burton's unmarked sedan, and a vented panel truck from Animal Control. Inside the apartment, Burton was attempting to interview Mona while the uniformed officers stood back watching the guy from Animal Control grapple with Benny Krill's mongoose. There was grunting and blood splatter. When Mona saw Yancey, she said,
"Shit, you are a cop. How bad did he cut you?"
Yancey pulled up his shirt. Mona grimaced.
"I never seen Benny like that before. He lost his goddamn mind is all," she said.
Burton led Yancey to the back bedroom and gave him a heated lecture, ending with,
"Andrew, this bullshit stops right now."
"Where's our suspect?"
"Like I would tell you."
"The wife claims she doesn't know, right?"
"We're still having that discussion," the detective said.
From the living room came a piercing cry. The mongoose had taken another bite out of the Animal Control officer. "If it's any consolation," Yancey said to Burton, "Blister stabbed me."
"And still you didn't call. Unfucking believable."
"Don't take it personally, Rog."
Yancey had known that either Burton or the Key West cops would eventually identify Krill from his tattoos and track him to Stock Island. It had been Yancey's hope that the hunt would take a few days, yet here they were already. He wondered if Mona would flip on her husband, assuming she knew where he went. Another yowl arose, followed by more shouting and bedlam. Mary rushed into the bedroom to report that the mongoose had been tased with unsatisfactory results. Burton threw his hands in the air, a gesture Yancey had seen many times. The two of them had had facing desks in the detective division. Yancey thought of how much he missed working with Burton. Through all the low times, Burton had stayed rock solid and loyal, even when Yancey disappointed him. "Rog, I'll tell you what I think I know."
"Just stick to the true parts, asshole."
"First, Blister's crazy as a shithouse rat. Second, he's got a major man crush on Buck Nance because of that idiotic TV show. That's probably why he went after the Muslim on the conch train. I also think he kidnapped Buck to be his best buddy. He's been holding him captive on a derelict boat, which just happened to sink off Sunset Key this afternoon with no hands aboard. My guess is that Blister's still got Buck locked up somewhere."
"This time you're wrong, Andrew. I can't tell you how good it feels to say that."
Burton was grinning.
"Nobody's got Buck Nance. He's safe, sound, and free as a bird."
The news jarred Yancey.
"Where the hell is he?"
"The sheriff couldn't care less, and neither should you."
One of the uniformed cops knocked on the door, saying the coast was clear, the mongoose having evaded capture and fled into the twilight. The officer from Animal Control was driving himself to the hospital to get his wounds treated. Yancey asked Burton how he knew for certain that Buck Nance was safe.
"Because he called Sonny."
"Okay, wait. Sonny spoke directly with Captain Cock?"
"Less than an hour ago. Nance apologized for all the hassle he'd caused. Said he was going through a rough patch and took some time off for personal reasons, which is Hollywood for dope, booze, or pussy."
Burton caught himself and turned sheepishly to Mary.
"Sorry. Women is what I meant to say. Dope, booze, and women."
She smiled.
"That's so sweet. Why can't I ever meet guys like you?"
Yancey pushed on. "How does Sonny know it was Buck on the phone?"
"Same voice from the TV show," said Burton. "Buck's agency sent Sonny a box of DVDs.
"Something's not right, Rog.
You want to get off my shit list? Swear out a complaint against Benny the Blister for jamming that blade in your belly."
Mary piped up.
I was there. I saw everything.
Outstanding. Then off we go.
Burton drilled Yancey with an expectant stare.
That way, if this shithead skates on the conch train case, at least we can nail him for trying to murder you. It's your civic duty, Andrew, to press charges. Also, you fucking owe me.
But Sonny'll go postal when he finds out what happened. I'll never get my badge back. The rest of my life, I'll be swabbing meat racks for E. coli.
Let me handle the sheriff, said Burton.
Mary tugged Yancey toward the door.
Come on, sugar, time to roll.
Raj, what you told me about Buck Nance, I'm not buying that story, Yancey said. The pieces don't fit.
Burton said the pieces fit splendidly. Andrew, listen to the lady. Go home, have a good night's sleep, and tomorrow get your ass back on the job.
Yes, Dad.
Your real job,
Burton added, as Mary pulled Yancey out the door.
Chapter 17. The furniture truck arrived with Yancey's new sofa, a 7-footer, slate gray with white piping on the cushions. He lay down for a trial nap and awoke helplessly to the sound of Mary chatting on his phone.
Why? He croaked after she hung up.
I called her because she has a right to know you got hurt.
What did she say? Is she coming back?
I promised her we hadn't slept together, Mary said. 50-50, she believed me.
But is she coming back?
Yancey sat up, wincing. She's not, is she? Mary stretched out, settling her head in his lap.
That gig at the morgue screwed her up big time. Swear to God, I couldn't do it. Working on stiffs all day? No way. She told me she's learning to ski. Cross country, not downhill. She said she's getting used to the cold.
I'm so glad you two got caught up. Want a pillow?
Don't tell me you're getting hard. Where's your famous manners, Andrew?
Pinned to the sofa, he folded his arms to limit the mischief. Mary's hair was fanned exotically across his knees. Her throat featured dainty freckles in a pattern like the Little Dipper.
Know what else Rosa told me? She said. They had only one murder in all Norway last week. A couple drunk farmers arguing over a crossword puzzle. One guy smacks the other with a manure shovel. She said you hardly ever hear sirens at night. Not like Miami, where it's dawn to dusk. I think she really feels safe there. Much as she adores you, Andrew, she needs to be somewhere other than here. By the way, your cock's poking me in the ear.
Do you not know anything about male hydraulics?
Mary closed her eyes, smiling.
I'm not worried. You're a hopeless gentleman.
Tell me who you are.
I did.
I mean your real name.
Who taught you how to nag? Mary said.
Not wishing to involve Rogelio Burton, Yancey had contacted some cop friends in Miami. As he'd expected, they couldn't find anyone named Mary Mansfield in the state or federal computers. It was a relief, in a way, because there was no tawdry rap sheet to visualize. He said,
I don't get why you're still here.
Meaning with you? Because it's not too boring. Plus, you got stabbed and need a driver. Relax, Andrew. I'll be gone soon.
No rush.
What are you going to do now that the riddle of Buck the missing redneck is solved?
Yancey said, Blister's still out there.
Your pal Burton will find him.
I need a project. You understand.
She drove him for a walkthrough at a Wendy's, which checked out okay except for one chartreuse burger patty. The mortified manager sailed it out the rear door to a waiting raccoon while Yancey looked the other way.
The next stop was a Parisian-style bistro where an amber fleck on a cheese cutting board turned out to be human earwax. The laconic teenage offender received a mild lecture on hygiene, and Yancey recorded the find as non-critical. Mary commented on his forgiving mood. "Just wait," he said. Two different customers at Stoney's Crab Palace had posted Instagram shots of mystery meat they'd been served as lamb kebabs. Tommy Lombardo said the photographs were inconclusive, and he asked Yancey to keep an open mind. After viewing the photos on his phone, Yancey told Mary to proceed straight to Stock Island. She dropped him in front of Stoney's, where he ambushed the owner in his office.
"Jesus, where'd you come from?"
Brennan cried. He was on his knees, tacking a rust-brown pelt to a bare pine plank. Yancey said, "Is that what I think it is?"
"The mink I told you about. So what? The lady who owned it changed her mind."
"It's not a mink, you moron." Brennan said,
"Her old man's hyperallergic, so she sold it to me for 75 cash. The fur is like a major score. I'm going to sell it to Bergdorf's."
"What did you do with the rest of it?" Brennan wouldn't look him in the eye. "The meat," Yancey said. "Shanks, loins, shoulders, where is it?"
"Threw it all away."
"I can't decide what's worse, you're lying or you're cooking." Brennan smoothed the edges of the pelt.
"Show me in the code where it says you can't serve mink."
"First of all, it's a fucking mongrel.